Hi, hello. We have a fun and jam-packed episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, we go to the Dunker Spot mailbag. On the NBA side, we answer plenty of questions, who we're excited to watch, how we watch basketball. We dig into all of that. And then a series of interviews. We talked to Portland Fire head coach Alex Arama, get into his process. We talked to Chicago Sky rookie Gabriella Jaquez. We bounce around with her, what her rookie season has been like. We had a lot of fun with this episode. We hope you enjoy. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, happy Friday, sir. How are you?
Hello, it's me. What's up?
No way. I guess this is how we are kicking off the Friday show. I'm in an undisclosed location in Chicago right now. Excited for all-star things happening over the weekend. But for today's NBA section, we want to hear from you. So we went to the Dunker Spot mailbag. Thank you to those who sent in questions. And as always, you can send those questions in at any time, dunkerspot@yahoo.com, whenever you have basketball thoughts for us. But we start with Ed, who gives us a very easy prompt to kick things off with. In your estimation, which team has had the best offseason so far? So, Steve, who are some teams that you were considering? Who'd you ultimately land on as the team that's had the best offseason so far?
Well, shout out to Ed and Eddie. But I would probably start the bidding with the Miami Heat. I think if you're Miami and you've been searching for a quote-unquote whale for years upon years, and you eventually find Giannis Antetokounmpo by trading half your team, that's a big win for you. I don't know, like they have rosters to fill. They might be waiting on a certain individual, whatever it is. But you got Giannis, and so he's going to draw the attention of defenses. He's a good playmaker. He's a great passer. Defensively, him and Bam are going to be fantastic. We've gone over the fantastic portion of it, but I think making that step in this Eastern Conference that is open, this NBA that is open, okay, this is our time to try and make a swing. Let's do it. So Miami is probably where I start. I admire Portland taking a swing in my head. Like, I really like that. I like that Portland said, hey, you know what? Let's go get Ja Morant. Damian Lillard's coming back. So I just enjoyed that. Like, I like the attempt. I know sometimes it's easy to kind of get into, well, are you a true contender? Or no, I like to see teams swing for it. And I like what Philadelphia did. Well, if you don't want Jaylen Brown, we'll take Jaylen Brown to add to Tyrese Maxey and Joel Embiid and BJ Edgecombe. And like, I want to see how that fit looks like. But those are probably the top three off the top of my head who had the best off seasons to me. I think a lot of teams did good work on the margins, like the Spurs. Did really well. Let's add Tobias Harris. Like, those kind of moves do count and they're impactful. But those are probably where I would start. What say you?
Okay, I like it. Like, I also had Miami and Philly on my list. Like, I was a fan of the Philly offseason before the Jaylen Brown trade. Like I said very early on, I like the Dane Wade signing. You get the Anthony Simons signing. They just pilfer all of the Portland two-way guys. It's very fun, just under the radar stuff for them getting Caleb Love and things like that. It's like, I like what Philly's doing to round out their roster. And then they swing for Jaylen Brown. It's like, okay, well, this feels pretty darn good. So you've already mentioned Miami, so I'm not going to hang there too long. Since this is offseason, it's kind of zoomed out for the draft for me as well. I would like to add the Memphis Grizzlies in this. It's like, I have really enjoyed the Cam Boozer experience. I think they just nailed the draft in general. And then some of the process things, like let's move back a spot, get some extra second round picks on top of that. So I think they did a really good job from asset acquisition standpoint as well. And it's funny that you start with like the Ja Morant trade. It's like, I feel like Jeremy Grant plus Chris Murray is pretty decent return. They add some more wings to the room, gives them some more lineup versatility, gives them some more versatility and depth in general. So, like, I just kind of like what Memphis is doing with their roster. I like the way the draft went for them. Adding Isaiah Stewart into the mix, like, I think they have done a really good under-radar job, and I'm excited to see what this team looks like this year. So, aside from Philly and Miami, I like the San Antonio shout as well. Wanted to give Memphis some love for what they've been able to do during this offseason. So we can move to the next question from, is the E.T. Spaceman? That's how I read it, but I'm not sure if I have that right. You can yell at me if you're not too long-time followers. I do appreciate the question, but a ranking space exercise man, question
man,
for you.
Spaceman. Yeah, that's them.
There you go. Ranking exercise question for you. Who are the teams you are most excited to watch next season? I love these kind of open-ended ones.
This is an unfair question to ask in July. And I like it. I like the question. It's a good question. But for me, it's unfair because, like, for me, at the start of the season, I like to see the new teams. Like, what are you trying to do? What are you attempting to do? What's going to make you good? What's intriguing about you? What are you lacking? So my mind is going to go to all the teams that did something different. So, like, Minnesota's up there for me. So, like, what does Chris Finch hatch up with LaMelo Ball and Anthony Edwards? And what does that open up offensively if they have some smaller ball lineups? And does that kind of shift what they want to do mindset-wise, ball movement-wise, et cetera, et cetera? Like, I'm intrigued to see how they kind of balance that out. So, like, a team like that jumps out to me. I'm excited to see, like, the Lakers. Like, hey, Luka Doncic, you are the guy, and we have put together a team that should help you out. Here's a roller and spacing and people who can drive closeouts. So what does Luka look like in this environment? What's Austin Reeves look like in this environment without LeBron James? I'd probably go the Houston Rockets. Okay, last year was last year. You did win 52 games. What's the next evolution of this team? What are you trying to do to improve on that? What are you trying to stack on top of that? The Heat, obviously, for reasons that I've listed before. The Knicks, how do you look trying to defend this championship? You won it. You did it. Okay, so now what's your evolution there? The Pistons, a lot of people maybe not understanding or respecting your offseason. You won 60 games last year. Is the defense hit the same level? Offensively, what's your evolution? Like, that's why I said it's an unfair question to ask in July, because I'm excited to see everyone, because I don't know what you're going to do. Philadelphia, hey, how's this going to work? Drive and kick? You did it last year. If Joel Embiid's healthier, we know he can elevate the ceiling. Jaylen Brown is also there. What are we doing putting this all together? The Magic. I'm excited to see the Magic. Hey, can you get your defense back to a high level and then also do better things offensively? Like, I have a tough time in July not being excited about watching teams, because, like, I want to see what the Bulls try and do. How does Caleb Wilson fit in this environment? The Grizzlies, Cam Boozer, how does he fit in that? Like, the Jazz. I'm excited to see the Jazz. Like, What is there, with what Will Hardy has done offensively to kind of just insulate and make everyone a little bit better? What does that look like? So, long story, more longer than it needed to be. I'm excited to watch everyone. The guys, what do you think?
Like you, Steve, this is why we get to do the podcast together. The answer is yes, in earnest, because everybody has something, and there are a lot of big swings that have happened this offseason. You want to see how they work. For me, literally in my notes, I have Miami in parentheses, really the Southeast Division, because, like, I am just intrigued by that entire group of teams, because that could just technically be my five if I want to do that. But Miami's there. You already mentioned Minnesota.
What did Zach Lowe do to you?
He didn't do anything to me.
Okay. You sure?
Yes. I said the Southeast thing before we had him on. What do you mean? But in all seriousness, Miami, of course, you want to see how the Giannis situation fits. And if they end up adding the other guy, then obviously that adds another flavor of what is this Miami team going to look like. But you mentioned Minnesota, so won't hang there too long. San Antonio, like, what are they going to do at the four? And then there's naturally the Victor Wembanyama of it all. Does Dylan Harper take another step? Does Stephon Castle take another step? Does De'Aaron Fox bounce back? Like, there's a lot of intrigue there, and they're really good. Oklahoma City is always one of my favorite teams to watch. The defense is absurd. Shea is absurd. Hopefully a healthier Jalen Williams. Hopefully a healthier Thunder team in general. And now, like, Lu Dort out the door, Aaron Wiggins out the door, Isaiah Joe out the door. That means more opportunity for Isaiah Joe and Cason Wallace and other guys stepping up. Like, what is that going to look like? And I would also like to add the Boston Celtics to the mix. As you mentioned, Philadelphia, like, they're adding Jaylen Brown. The Boston Celtics are now sliding in Paul George. They are sliding in Mitchell Robinson. Like, I want to see what this looks like. I have pretty high hopes about what it's going to look like, at least during the regular season, but I'm excited to watch that team play basketball, as they were a very good team last year as well. So that is probably where I go. Memphis, Utah. I love the Utah shout. Is that why we got the Utah yellow on today? Were you ready to shout out the Utah Jazz? Okay, well, I tried to bridge it together. That's fine.
No, I just hadn't worn the shirt in a while.
You know what? That's fair. That is fair. All right, let's go to the next question from Short Pinkletown. How do y'all watch the regular season? I mean, literally, I'm amazed at the amount of quality analysis y'all can put up, even knowing that it's your job. When you watch a game, is it the whole game, clips? How much b-ball are you watching on an average day, and in what format or order?
How much ball are you watching? A lot. How do I explain the psychosis that I have, the illness that I have when it comes to watching the game of basketball? I don't really necessarily know, but we'll give it a shot. So, like, let's say regular season starting, I'm looking at certain matchups, but I'm going to start whenever the first game is, I'm going to start with whatever game is on. And I'm going to put that on. Yeah, I may or may not have another screen. If there's two games going, I'll put those on. Let's start here. We're going to bounce around. And so the live viewing experience is a little bit different because there is a bounce around element to it, but I am locking in on certain things depending on how games are going, what matchups are going, who's attacking who, whatever it is. So it can kind of vary from basis to basis. So there's a big matchup. Okay, I'm watching this game. I might lock in a little bit more on Heat Bucks, right? But I'm also keeping an eye on what else is happening to see what is occurring. Depending on what happens on that night, the next day, I'm looking at what else happened that I may have missed, right? Throughout my bounce around, remote control, whatever. So now I'm going to absorb the rest of those games. And so, okay, how did this team win? What do I need to do? So I'm going to wake up early in the morning, I'm going to watch. And like, so I am going to watch the game. And so if I feel it was a close game, maybe we start in the second half. If I feel it was a blowout, maybe we start in the first half. But I'm just going to cycle through like 3, 4, 5 games. Now it varies. Like if I know a team, I might check in the next day or the day after, if that makes sense. If I know what the Knicks are and they had a result, I might not run to it, right? I might watch everything else. But let me peek in, see what they're doing and kind of build the book that way. So it's like, it's hard to explain because there's enough hours in the day and it doesn't make a ton of sense. But I'm always watching in the morning, the afternoon, and then whatever games are happening at night. So it's a catch-up process. It's a rewatch process. It's a rewind process. So, I mean, if it's a blowout game, I'm not watching the full 48. I'm going to watch the bulk of it to kind of understand, okay, how did this get away? And once I feel like it got away, okay, we're good. But I'm not watching free throws. There's stuff I'm skipping, you know what I'm saying? So we're getting to the meat and potatoes of what happened and like trying to understand it. So I hope this answers this question, but it's like, I don't know if I can explain how the brain, the noggin makes this work all the time. Like I just kind of keep watching and watching and watching and watching. And so like, I feel like me and Nikias are a little bit different because like I can absorb the multitude of there are 12 games on this one night. Am I watching all 12 games? Fully? No. But I can get a good feel on most of them. And I can know, okay, this is what happened, this is what happened, this is what happened. And now I can kind of go back in the morning and kind of laser in on X, Y, Z. And you just kind of keep going, you keep building. For me, it's like you're creating a book. I want to fill my book up on how I feel about this team. So who am I needing to learn more about? What are they doing well? What are they not doing well? And you just kind of go through the waves and ebbs and flows of the season. So like Spurs are a proven product. I like watching the Spurs. I watched the Spurs a lot last year. I may watch the Spurs less to start next year because I kind of know who they are. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I think that's fair. Like, I think for me, well, let's get the easy stuff out of the way. Like, yeah, we are skipping free throws. We are skipping timeouts. Like, let's try to make this as close to 48 minutes or, you know, if it's overtime, 53, whatever. Let's make that as close to that as we can. Because I know there's going to be rewinding for me. There's going to be, like, slow-mo for me. If it's a game that I want to watch and also, like, clip to the timeline, then I know that's going to be a longer experience. So, like, whatever I can kind of chop out, I'm certainly going to try to do that. But in terms of general game watching, I very much want to I want to lock in on like a double header if I can, even if it's not the natural TV one. I want an early slate game and a late game slate or a late slate game for my live watching. So I can just kind of laser in on this is the game I want to see. And then this is the other game that I want to see. And like you, I'm like, I'm peeping the box score, I'm peeping my timeline. Like if something crazy is happening, then that may influence what I'm going to watch or what I'm going to start with to watch the next day. But I generally want to focus in on two for live watching. Because as we've done quite a bit of bouncing around with like our watch parties and things like that, it's like, okay, I need to be able to kind of streamline some of this just to help my brain a little bit. And then I could do my own bouncing around in the morning where I can kind of you know, kind of figure things out from there. Now, as this regular season is long, like, I want to try to keep a, oh, go ahead.
We're going to bring you back, buddy. We're going to bring you back to the chaos. Yeah, come on, cool, back. Come on, so, back. Come on. Come on. Come on.
It's, try it's to, so
don't,
much chaos.
Don't duck the smoke. Come watch basketball with the pals.
Come dump the smoke was crazy. But no, but like that's generally how I want to handle my nights. Then in the morning, it's very much, okay, what seems like the most interesting game of the night from the night before that I didn't watch? That might be what I start with. Or as we get like deeper into a regular season, that may be, hey, I saw the Knicks on Monday. It's now Saturday. Let me check back in on them. Or I haven't watched the Bucks in a little bit. Let's streamline that. Or like as someone that likes to look at different numbers and things like that, if I see a team that's like, they've won 7 of their last 8. I'm like, okay, this might just be a day, especially if it's a like a Tuesday, it's going to be like 2 or 3 games that night. That might be a day where it's like, actually, I'm just spending my early portion of the day just watching 2 or 3 games from this team just to kind of catch up. Or if I'm looking at some of the team-based stats, okay, the Heat have the 18th best defense over the last 3 weeks. I'm just going to the Clips portion of that. All right, cool. I'm just about to watch a whole bunch of Heat defensive possessions to see, okay, why has the defense slid to a certain degree? You can insert any team name there. But that's where some of the clips come in, or if there's, you know, rookies that I'm looking at, rookie guards, okay, let's just watch a bunch of their pick and roll possessions and see what that part looks like. And you can just kind of streamline things from there. But yeah, live viewing, give me an early game, a late game. The next day I'm watching them doing the catch-up process, similar to Steve, kind of deciding what was exciting, what was a blowout that I didn't expect on either side. Did a good team get blown out? Why did that happen? Did a dominant team have like a historic night? I want to see how that happened. And then there's also just, I need to catch up on this team so I can still have a full grasp on like the 30.
This is where we have a difference, because I don't like committing to 2 games. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know who's playing. I don't know what we're at. So hey, whatever is about to happen, let's see what happens. If I get stuck, I get stuck on teams. I mean, Pacers, you start early. I'm just watching 45 minutes of Pacers. Didn't expect to do that. Whatever it is, I kind of just like to ebb and flow with it. And like, if a team's playing well and they blow a team out, well, then you're out for the night. I'll kind of peep and see what you did maybe the next day or whatever. But okay, you're good and you did good things. Bye. Like, it's just, it's an intrigue level. It's hard to explain. So, Shorp Pinkletown, I hope this helped. I appreciate your support. But we are crazy people who watch a lot of basketball.
Yeah, it goes without saying that the process also carries over to the W side as well. Like, that's just kind of how we go about it. Mm-hmm. It's just a year-long process of watching an ungodly amount of basketball. People ask me, like, how do we do this? I'm just like, a lot of love and a little bit of sleep. Like, that's just kind of how you have to do it if you're going to be as in-depth as we try to be.
It's one of those things that you do, and when people ask you, it's like, well, I don't really know how to explain this. Like, I'm not lying to you, but, like, it's hard to, like, put it into words.
When you ask...
I am ill. Like, I don't know.
No, it's always a funny bit. Like, I know throughout years of the pod, we'll move to the next question. But, like, I know sometimes you'll wake up early and see I'm threading something early. It's like, oh, well, I see what caught his eye. Same thing for me. I'll wake up randomly. You're up at, like, 6:17. And it's just like, oh, well, Steve just has 3 clips on the timeline from a game from last night already. It's like, we just do it. And then when you have to vocalize what you're doing, it's like, oh, that does kind of sound crazy, huh? it is 7 a.m. and we're watching Wizards Clippers. That's all right. Fair enough. Okay. The next question is going to come from Josh, who says, as a Magic fan, we have been barely mentioned by any NBA podcast I listen to. What's your outlook on us this season? We haven't really made any meaningful moves besides getting a new coach. Do you think we'll make the playoffs? Josh, you have come to the right place.
I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised, Josh. I mean, I think the key with getting Sean Sweeney is, will that elevate your defense back to where it needed to be for all of the rest to work? Like, I don't know what they're going to run offensively as of now. We're in July. Mm-hmm. But I felt like the defense slipping last year really exacerbated a lot of the issues. And, like, obviously injuries didn't help, but, like, you can't afford for your defense to just not be really good with this current roster. Mm-hmm. So if you fix that and they defend at a high level, does that now re-unlock a lot of things? Can you try different concepts to unlock Paolo, to have Desmond Bane playing well, to have Franz playing well? Like, you have the talent, you have the pieces, you have the size, you have the length. Can you get the defense back up to a certain level and make a run based on that? That's the intrigue there. So I don't necessarily think the Magic, oh, they're done. I was a strong believer in the Magic last year. For as long as I could, I held on to my ticket on that train until they told me to get out. And I left. So I was like, all right, I guess. And even then, that version of the Magic gave an uncomfortable series to the Detroit Pistons. So I think mm-hmm. the Magic have something that works. It's just, okay, can we rebuild a formula that elevates everyone? So the defense gets mm-hmm. high, and Paolo and Franz are able to kind of have a little bit more synergy. You unlock things offensively. I think there is a higher ceiling than people expect.
Oh, man, Josh, you've come to the right place to talk about the Orlando Magic. Because, buddy, you were high on the Magic heading into the year, Steve. I was high on the Magic heading into the year. And who, boy, did they not have a fun time. Can I just want to toss one stat out here that kind of reaffirms my Magic intrigue and my belief that I think they're going to be very good, and I do think they're just going to be a playoff team if they are healthy. The five-man lineup of Jalen Suggs, Desmond Bane, Franz Wagner, Paolo Banchero, Wendell Carter Jr., played 272 minutes together last year, including the playoffs. To put that into perspective, during the regular season, Dante DiVincenzo, Anthony Edwards, Jaden McDaniels, Julius Randle, Rudy Gobert, 710 minutes during the regular season. We didn't even get 300 from the ideal starting lineup from Orlando last year, and they had a plus 12.4 net rating in those 272 minutes. There is a really good team in here, and we saw flashes of it last year, and as you alluded to in the playoffs, they just got nasty with the Detroit Pistons, but ultimately couldn't get the job done. And so if you're telling me that there's going to be a healthier Jalen Suggs, a healthier Franz Wagner, a healthier Paolo Banchero, to your point, Steve, Sean Sweeney is able to tap into more of the defense, and, you know, bouncing off of something that Franz Wagner alluded to, just having a different voice in the room may be enough to kind of make things feel differently in Orlando. I am once again going to be pretty high. Like, I did get a good chuckle out of, hey, let's bring Vooch back. Let's get the old thing back real quick. Javon Carter's back.
Hey, Vooch.
I want to see more Anthony Black. Like, I just, like, they have Vooch real quality pieces.
Vooch is sitting in the crib saying, you know what? I'm good.
It's time.
can I play? Can I just stay here?
I want to go and stay home. I respect that so much for the goal of Hootie. But, like, the bench is interesting. I think the starter group, there's a nucleus here that I think can work, especially if they stay healthy. And if Sean Sweeney, like, changes the spacing principles, it changes, like, the tempo for them. Like, there's some low-hanging fruit for the Orlando Magic to grab that can make them really good, especially if they stay on the court. So, I'm kind of in on the Magic experience, and if I have to take another L on them, then I'll just do that. But that is where I'm at with Orlando as of July 24th, at the very least. All right, next one coming from Eeyore, and it has questions for each of us, Steve. So for you, Steve, power rank the Southeastern Division based on your excitement for the teams in the division and why.
Shout out to Eeyore. love that question. Don't know why the smoke got directed to me, but I love Eeyore, so we're good to go. The Southeast Division is fun and should be a lot yes. of fun. And so if I had to power rank exactly where I'm at, I put Miami number one. I want to see what Giannis does within this context. I want to see what Spo mm-hmm. tries to do with Giannis. I want to see what they try and do defensively, different coverages, how much zone do you use. I want to see how much drive and kick you get to, how much pick and roll you get to, the invert things with Giannis. Like, I think I put the intrigue level of, like, I always love watching Miami, but now you have Giannis, so I want to really see what you do. So Miami's probably mm-hmm. number one for me. I'm going to go with the Atlanta Hawks at two because of the season they had last year. And so can you build on that, right? Like, yeah. So Nikhil Alexander-Walker played really well. Jalen Johnson played really well. Dyson Daniels is a great defensive player. Lou Dort is added to the program. You found something that many people didn't expect for you to find once you kind of moved on from Trae Young. Can CJ McCollum do it again? What does that look like night to night? What's the pace? What's the mm-hmm. tempo? How do you get going? Number three for me, and this is not purely, like, I want to see what the Magic do. Like, I love watching the Magic play defense, and I like watching kind of their style of play. What is that going to be this year is interesting to me. So mm-hmm. does Paolo take another leap in a different area that people don't anticipate? Does Franz take a leap in a different area that people don't anticipate? Does the defense elevate, and does that make them a more fun team? We saw them experiment with pace and tempo last year, and it had results until it didn't. So what's that look like? The Hornets are right there. And, like, the ordering of this is nasty because I do want to see all of these teams, but because I've been forced to order them, it sounds like I'm down on some teams, and I'm not. the Hornets are fun to watch. And so what's the next evolution for them? Where, okay, you double down on, we have movement, we have Brandon Miller, we have Konkanipo, we can kind of go side to side, we can put pressure on teams a different way, we'll defend. What does that look like after kind of having a level of success? The Wizards are five, but they're not really five. Because I want to see what the Wizards look like with Trae Young, Anthony Davis, AJ DeBonta. Do those three help to elevate a team that's fun? Like, the Wizards were fun last year until they weren't. First quarter, second quarter, you know what I mean? Et cetera, et cetera. So do they stabilize a little bit having Trae Young pick and roll, having Anthony Davis post-ups, having AJ DeBonta kind of be able to mix in around it, not necessarily carry the entire usage offensively? Like, what does that look like? You know what, Nikias? I'll give you this.
Okay.
The Southeast Division may be the most fun division in the National Basketball Association.
Folks, clip it, save it, share it, distribute it, lock it in, add it to your bookmarks. We heckin' did it. Steve is on the Southeast Division train with me. Let's heckin' go. And now the question for me from Eeyore. What group of veterans are you most excited to see continue to get together this season? Who do you think will see the most improvement from continuity? And, like, I struggled with this one, not because of the actual bit, but I was like, is it, like, two veterans? Is it four veterans? Am I doing, like, average age of the team to figure out who the veteran teams are? So, like, I had a whole, like, process thing of, like, who would count in this thing. And so, like, what I had down in my notes was, like, if the Knicks count, I start with them. As a group of vets, like similar to you, Steve, it's like, what does this title defense look like? It's like, where does Jalen Brunson go from here? Do we get more Mikal Bridges usage? Are we going to see, like, what does year two of the Cat experience under Mike Brown look like in particular? Because as we saw in the playoffs, once they kind of hit nirvana of the mix of Cat usage and Jalen Brunson usage, there really wasn't much you could do with this Knicks offense. When you also have OG Anunoby knocking down threes and Mikal Bridges cutting and knocking down threes, the subs come in, they kind of keep things afloat. And so, like, in a literal sense, I start with New York, just how do they build on what this was? Because obviously they got through some of the growing pains and they won a freaking title. And so I want to see what that part looks like. Secondly, it's like whoever LeBron goes to at this point, because, like, you're just going to have to establish some level of chemistry there. And he is going to teams that have ready-made cores of being, well, at least among the teams that have been listed as suitors. Like, if it's the Warriors, like, you've had Steph and Draymond together for X amount of years. If it's the Heat, you do have Bam, you have some of the others that have been there. I feel like LeBron's going to try to help elevate that group alongside Giannis and things like that. So, like, the LeBron team's kind of on the list for me by default. And Denver was kind of who I used as the team to answer the second half of the question for. Because, like, they were not very healthy last year either. And as we are still waiting to see what happens with Peyton Watson, like, one, is he going to be part of the continuity bit? Not a veteran, per se, but is he going to be part of the continuity bit? And in general, another year of Murray, Jokic, Aaron Gordon, are they able to build another deep run? Because as we've seen with how Denver's kind of handling their offseason and just in general how they go about their financials, if they are not positioned to make another Western Conference Finals run or Finals run, is this going to be the last run for this Denver core before some kind of salary move is made? And so, like, I have my eyes on Denver, but if they are healthier this year, they should be pretty darn good, headlined by Nikola Jokic. So those are the teams that I am keeping my eye on the veteran front.
This is Mike Conley erasure. Mike Conley erasure. Mike Conley erasure. To the next question.
I don't know if that counts. Okay. The next one coming from Trendon Watford Trufer, which, talk about a name after my own heart. That is fire. Dunker Nation, first, I would like to thank you both for discussing the John Morant acquisition without immediately diving into a racialized analysis of John Morant's character vis-a-vis the Portland locker room. I've been very disappointed with how other podcasts began the discussion of this trade with a combination of his personal character. John clearly had some rough moments in Memphis, but those also began when he was 22 and have largely subsided by 25. To the question, how do front offices account for players' maturation when researching potential additions to their team, particularly for young players? And what, if anything, would you change about NBA discourse regarding reclamation projects and locker room cancers?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of intel that goes into players more than people think. Like, from the draft process, a lot of it is scouting, but it's also doing the work to just find out who this person is, who they're around, what is their character. Like, there's the intel work that starts as soon as you are going towards the NBA. Mm-hmm. Like, there are people like who are in the player personnel department who are just gonna go and watch and go to games and see, okay, so how do you warm up? What are you looking like? What's your body language? Like, there's a lot of built up things there that people, people assume that, oh, they don't do the work. No, there's so much work that's done on who these people are to try and understand, will that be a fit in our locker room? So I think that's probably the one thing I probably try and open people's eyes up on. And kind of like, there's a baseline and people can have their book on a player, right or wrong, but they can see the changes as they grow into who they are. And that plays a lot of the role into the decision, especially because different teams will appreciate or be able to understand different players in a way that some teams may not. Like, we can kind of take on who you are and we believe in who you are. Some teams may not have that same process because of who they already have. So it gets a little tricky. What I changed about discourse regarding it, like, this is the thing about today's world. Perception is carrying a lot of weight. And the way that people perceive you is going to kind of alter a lot of the thought process to a degree. And that good, bad, I don't know if I love it, but if you have done certain things, you may be perceived in a certain light. And so how do you handle that? How do you execute that? What do you do with that? And we always see when a player gets traded or a player doesn't get signed, there's a follow-up afterwards, right? There's the end story that comes out. Remember when Dylan Brooks, the end of the Memphis tenure.
Yeah.
A lot of the noise was, I would never want to have this person on my team. And I was like, that's feels like a lot.
Feel strong.
Yeah. I understand that he carried himself with a certain level of swagger in Memphis, but like, I don't know if we need to say, oh, we don't need to roster Dylan Brooks. And then everywhere he's gone since, he's elevated a team. So I would just change the way that we focus in and understand the context. And it would probably bring me back to just humanizing these players a little bit more and understanding that they are humans to a degree. And this is a work environment. Like, I know there's a lot of money involved. It's a sport, but like, sometimes you may not be in the best situation for you. And that may not be the best situation for the team. And these things happen. That does not automatically mean that the next place you go, it's going to be a copy and paste scenario. So that's probably what I would try and change. Like, try and take a look at what has led to this result you don't like, and then move forward from there, as opposed to, well, this person can't get it done. This person is XYZ. What does that do? You're handicapping that player. You're putting them in a box. And for me, like, I don't think you should ever put anyone in a very specific box.
Mm-hmm.
We're all different. We all do different things. We're all weird in our own ways. And you kind of got to embrace the people that they are, in my opinion.
No, I think you were all over my notes. You pretty much nailed that one. I think it all comes down to like humanizing these players and understanding that people grow and people thrive in different contexts and may struggle in others. I think for us as analysts, because there is such a natural emphasis on analyzing the basketball of it, how good is this player? How do they fit with others? Obviously, there are contracts attached. Like, how does that affect team building, et cetera? It's so easy to start there and then index on, oh, if you were a potential problem, you need to stay away because you may threaten everything else. And I get where that can come from, but I feel like it's kind of come at the expense of understanding that we are still talking about human beings at the end of the day. And so obviously there are just some non-negotiables. Like, if you are in the news for a number of things, it's just like, I really don't care how good you are at basketball. Like, no, I don't really want to deal with this. Teams don't want to deal with this, et cetera. And I think that part is fair. But like, underneath that tier, I think there's a little more wiggle room, a little more gray area that I think people give credit for. And I think just kind of understand what the context is where it gets important. All right, last one on the mailbag front. This one coming from Frankie. Says, hey fellas, few times, long time. Questions for both. For me, in the spirit of Skilo's 1995 classic, who are five active NBA and WNBA players you wish were a little bit taller? Jace Richardson inspired this for me. Let's avoid anybody who's height advantage for fun. So no 8-foot Wimby or 7-foot LeBron. I love this question. And so I'll quickly go through my names. And so on the NBA side, I start Jalen Williams, the wing for OKC, as he's like 6'5", can guard a little bit of everyone. If he was like a legit 6'7", or 6'8", wing, I don't know what you do with him. He just further amplifies OKC's defensive versatility. And I think they would just have, because the one question I've always had with OKC in the playoffs context with their defense is like, they have a bunch of great defenders, but like Cason Walls is like 6'3", Lou Dort when he was the Thunder was like 6'3", 6'4", Jalen Williams 6'5", et cetera. If they actually just have a 6'8 wing defender, good luck to all of you. So Jalen Williams is on the list. Bam Adebayo is like 6'9", plus wingspan, of course, but if he was like a legit 6'11 center, maybe wouldn't have the is he a power forward or is he a center conversations. We would just firmly recognize that he's a five. But if he was more center-sized, at bare minimum, maybe the Jokic matchups looks a little bit different for him. Darius Garland, Lou Dort, Jose Alvarado rounds out the NBA list for me. And on the W side, Alyssa Thomas, so she could actually play, maybe just be a five versus playmaker four that is just center strong, et cetera. Kelsey Plum's on the list for me. Gabby Williams on the list for me if she's like a legit 6'1", 6'2 wing. That gets a lot of fun with the athleticism and the skill set she has. Dana Evans, Georgia Amore are the other two that I would add on the list. And for Steve, you are usually very respectful and cordial to players and coaches, which I think is an awesome quality to have. Anyways, when you were coaching, what players and or coaches would have you think to yourself, he's with us? No politically correct answers.
No politically. Well, I mean, here's the thing, right? There's a delusion you have to have in the game of basketball. And so you have a belief level in your team to kind of achieve a certain level of success. And you have a healthy respect for your opponent where, like, to this day, Reggie Jackson still haunts me because of how he played in the playoffs against us in Memphis. See, even saying it out loud kind of just is like a gut punch. So it's hard to like say, he's with us. Like, I didn't want to be KG on the second row saying, you know, trash can person. I didn't want to do that. However, because it's been requested, Eric Bledsoe, I always felt like, whatever, man, do what you gotta do.
Muscles you gotta for no reason.
Just hey, sure, whatever. It was always also the like players who left a team that I was on in a playful banter manner. Like, oh, sure, OJ Mayo, get to your step back. That's fantastic. Oh, Rudy Gay, you're going to go jab and Jay. Like, cool. I've seen this before. And that might just be I supported you and we didn't have success. So now I'm rooting on your downfall. That might just be toxic, but you know, it is what it is. Who else do I think of? Dwight Howard loved when he made his first hook shot. Fantastic. Enjoyed that. Great process there. Who else? Ty Lawson, do whatever you want. That's fine. We'll figure it out. Don't worry about it. Michael Carter Williams. Like, I feel like I feel like I'm just talking about people. Well, these are good players, but it's just like if you want the who's with us all-star team, this is where I was at. Josh Smith, are you taking a jump shot? Fantastic. Love that for what we're trying to do. That's great. Deion Waiters, tween hezzy. Go ahead. Have a blast.
So much tween hezzy.
Hey, Greg Monroe, do that jab stuff. That's me. That's great. Love that. Please continue. Now the thing you gotta be careful with is you can't go too far into the he's with us because you may be on a different team and work with that player.
He's with you.
You can't like he's with me. So you gotta tread lightly a little bit and kind of be because like that's where I was at with Bargnani. I was like, cool, man, whatever. That's fantastic. And now guess who I'm depending on? I'm depending on Bargnani. That changes the math a little bit. Randy Foy as a concept. DJ Augustin taught me a lesson, so I'm not bringing his name up.
These are some names. Oh my.
Yeah, and here's the thing. I'm realizing that I'm old. That's interesting. Damari Carroll was one that also taught me some lessons. Hey, whatever, man. And then he kept making threes, and it's like, all right. You're not with us. Like, Gary Neal, once he left the Spurs, cool, man. I'm good.
I have had so many NBA 2K12 through 2K15 flashbacks as you go through this list of names. This is fantastic content. We are going to take a break, but when we return, Portland Fire head coach Alex Arama joins us for a wide-ranging conversation from basketball to saxophones to ice cream. We hope you enjoy. Stick with us. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot as we shift to the W side. And we have a very special guest. We have Alex Araba, the head coach of the Portland Fire, joining us for the first time. Hopefully not the only time. But coach, thank you for joining us. How are you doing?
Oh, it's a real pleasure to be on. So thanks so much for the invitation. Really excited to talk basketball with you guys. So yeah, let's get into it. But thanks again. It's going to be fun.
Of course. We're going to have some fun. A lot of basketball questions coming your way. But first, a very important question that I wanted to ask you to jump things off. When's the last time you played the saxophone?
That's an awesome question. Unfortunately, it's got to be like 2.5 years now. I left my saxophones in Italy. So I'm going to play them again in the off season. And then next season, I'm going to have to bring them to Portland.
Oh, yeah. You got to bring it in. How long have you been playing?
So I started when I was 12 years old. So it was Grover Washington. I was obsessed with it. It was the solo on Just the Two of Us that got me captivated, and played a lot of jazz, and just loved it. It's a great release from basketball.
I would imagine so. Okay. Well, let's dig into the basketball. I wanted to ask just on a very basic level, what initially drew you to the game of basketball?
Oh yeah. So I mean, coming from the UK, it's especially at the time when I was growing up, it wasn't a huge basketball market. It's become a lot more popular since. The two sports I actually started with were tennis and soccer. My dad is a tennis coach. And then 12 years old, I went to a game for the local professional team in my town, called the Guildford Heat at the time. And I was just hooked right away, loved the game. A week later, I signed up for their junior kind of academy teams. And that was it. So then I played in the youth categories there. And then I started coaching really early at 16. I think that's the best part of being in the UK. I had opportunities that I wouldn't have been able to benefit from if I was in other countries. And one being that, you know, basketball, they didn't have many coaches. So I started just volunteering to coach the younger team at my school. And then that led to me actually starting my own club. I basically hired the gym at my school at weekends. And, you know, it's a club system out there instead of playing really in school like you see here in the US. And that was the start of everything. So learned so much coaching from an early age, like learning more from how not to do it. But that was a great way to begin my coaching career.
It's a lot of initiative. I guess from that end, was there a particular coach that kind of inspired you on that front, or was it just looking for opportunities to stay within basketball? Well,
that's a great question. So at the time, and I was actually coaching girls basketball. So that was the whole club. It was actually a girls club, which was nice because then it came full circle, you know, coming to the W side. But we actually became, it was the best, though, we became one of the best girls programs in the UK. So, and my kind of, who I looked up to at the time were kind of NCAA celebrity college coaches. And then I think it was about 3 or 4 years, and I'd also say it was like the era where skills trainers were really at the beginning of trying to, you know, become more popular. So very different to kind of where I am now. And then it was about, so I started coaching when I was 6. It was only 22, 23 when I came across more evidence-based coaching and the idea that there was science linked to how you could coach. And I was blown away because I'd say, honestly, guys, prior to that, I was doing it, you know, the normal way. And not to say that's wrong, but I just didn't realize that there was actually ways we could coach that aligned with how athletes learned. So, you know, I was kind of just following everything I could see on YouTube. I remember when I was like 16, I was watching all the FIBA coaching clinics from all the, you know, great European coaches, which are awesome. Then I'd watch like championship productions, DVDs. I'd buy all of them. I was obsessed with learning, but I didn't really know. I didn't have a filter. And I think that's really important because I think I see that a lot in the present day with coaches. It's tough. You know, when we're learning to coach, I think we're very influenced by lots of different kind of sources as opposed to really finding a few things that can help guide our learning.
Well, I was going to pop in real quick and just ask this question to you, coach. And obviously we're going to get towards the system to a degree, but how much of that trial and error, because I don't think a lot of people understand a lot of coaching is some of that trial and error, going through the highs and the lows. How important is that? And how did that help guide you kind of towards your beliefs right now?
Oh, great question. Honestly, I'd say that's a fundamental part of who I am today. And I think I was really fortunate because in Europe, before you get the chance to work with professionals, you have to basically earn your qualifications and learn to coach the youth sector. And I had that for many years where I was coaching youth basketball in Belgium initially, where I was directing an academy. And then I had 3 years in Italy. And then even in Spain, when I was working for the NBA Europe, I was coaching youth basketball for two of those seasons. But honestly, I wouldn't be where I am today without that. And I wholeheartedly believe that because the things I was able to try out without being concerned, oh, what if this doesn't work? Or what if the players don't understand this activity? And I was really just constantly experimenting. And I think Italy was the best thing because I was on court for 3 or 4 hours, 5 days a week. And that was, you know, some of the players, you know, we've had some good success at the club I was at with developing some really good youth prospects. Francesco Ferrari is like the biggest name right now in youth Italian basketball playing at Virtus Bologna. And Francesco was my project. And we'd work every day. And that was really me getting to grips with PD in this modern perspective and really just learning it for the first time. And then just trying things offensively, trying things defensively, seeing what worked, didn't work. And I remember, guys, I watched in those 3 years in Italy, I watched every single practice back. I had a $10 tripod, which I just linked up to my iPhone. My mornings, I'd be on court for like 6 a.m. for an hour. I'd go back home. I'd have my cappuccino, my Italian brioche, and I'd just watch the day before all the practices. Then in the afternoons, I'd be on court from like 2 to 5. It was, for 3 years, it was just like a dream. It was like the ultimate coaches finishing school.
Right.
Oh, that sounds awesome. I wanted to circle back very quickly because you mentioned that you started with tennis and soccer in particular. And I wanted to ask like how those sports kind of influenced the way that you see basketball or the way you kind of develop, the way that you got to create space in particular offensively.
Oh, yeah. Firstly, I think there's so much to learn from other sports. So I'm really intentional just spending time with trying to, you know, seek out the best coaches in all different sports and see what I can learn from them. I've been fortunate. Just recently, I've struck up a friendship with Fabian Hertzler, manager of Brighton in the Premier League. And, you know, we just talk about similarities between both sports and what we can take from each other. And I think a great example in football and soccer is it comes from German football managers. It's called the Gegenpress, where you lose possession of the ball and you're basically trying to win it back immediately with high pressing and things of that nature. And, you know, I'm sure you guys have seen us obviously this season with the full court pressure, and that really came from there in terms of, you know, obviously tagging up has been something spoken about in basketball the last few years, but I basically wanted to create a hybrid version that was more aggressive and also a little bit more geared towards all our crashing and just trying to generate those offensive rebounds, which are just so valuable. So that idea really did come from football and just seeing, I think the biggest difference in football the last few years, the huge spikes in intensity, distance covered, and all those load metrics. And that's actually something a lot of football teams measure now with their they have like a performance analytics department where they're really looking at things like top speeds, D cells, X cells, jumps. And that's something we've introduced in Portland because I think, and we're actually leading the league in most of those metrics. And I really do think it has a tangible impact on performance, especially the way we're trying to play.
Understood. I think bouncing off of that and just trying to establish that style of play, how do you kind of balance all the things, all the influence that you have to kind of build out the system and also still seeking out new information and still trying to add to what you're trying to build? How do you kind of strike the balance between the two?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when I got this job, before we had the team, the first thing I was looking at is what do I feel would be the greatest competitive advantage in this league, knowing that we're going to have to do some things differently because there is going to be a talent disparity for the first 2 years. It's just the nature of being an expansion team. So how can we find principles of play which are going to be difficult for other teams to defend offensively or then to execute their offense against? So that's really what I was reflecting on for months in terms of defensively, how could we disrupt as much as possible? And offensively, what would the playbook, like a very simple playbook, because I don't like having lots of things, but just executed to a elite level where instead of having, you know, like 15 completely random things, everything will land in the same spacing. It may have the same entry, but then we're going to go to different things and just have, you know, out of like our Spain pick and roll, we know every single time based on how they got it, what we're looking for. And that to me is, that will give us a good foundation in year two and year three to add some more complexity to our entries and sets. But really in year one, it's how can we have the foundation of these coverage solutions and have an answer to always make the defense wrong. So I was looking at all those things. And then once we got the players, it was then a case of balancing the principles I thought would be a big advantage with the players we had and then making compromises here and there, but also thinking, all right, strategically, who do we want to build around? Who, you know, in 2-3 years when we're talking about really wanting to make noise in the playoffs, what's going to help us the most then? So it's some very, you know, like it's very, these things really overlap and it's quite complex. And then, you know, an obvious one that I can just mention now was shooting fives. I fought with Megan DeLeo now. Obviously Meg just changed her surname, getting married. But I thought that was a huge advantage in terms of, I think, defending stretch fives, picking and popping in great spacing. I don't think we see lots of right now in the W. And I felt like that would be a huge advantage because if teams don't often have to defend it and execute against it, then they play us. Well, that's perfect. And then how can we use wrinkles? You know, we played Dallas yesterday and then it's all right, now they anticipate the pick and pop. So then ATOs, we're going to play with that and we might roll Meg. We might create a different spacing where we have BC, so they're not helping off her. And then we roll, we get a layup. Then we're going to run our Spain and then they don't know if Meg's going to pop, if she's going to roll. And it's just all these intricacies that we're, it's essentially we see one thing that the team can't guard and then we just want to relentlessly go to that and add wrinkles to it to always keep them guessing what's coming next.
I think within that, one of my favorite things about watching Portland this year is what you spoke to. Just, we have our spacing principles. We can get to different spacing looks. And then based on what you're doing, we can alter things on the fly. And I don't think that's an easy thing to establish, especially with an expansion group. And so what I wanted to ask is what has it been like teaching this new group and having them kind of read the game in this way, but also empower them to kind of read things in their own way?
Oh, it's honestly been one of the most rewarding parts of the job. Just, you know, even just getting the feedback from the players where they're like, wow, like this year I've learned so much and I really feel like I'm actually seeing the game differently. Like that, it's, and credit, you know, to the whole staff. It's, you know, luckily I'm so fortunate to have such a great group of coaches here, and that's all their work with the players on a daily basis, all the individual film, all of that stuff. But I think that's the, with this type of offense, I knew like there would be some growing pains. And I think it's maybe you're a little bit worse early on in year one to be really good later on once you're establishing that foundation. And I think, you know, I see it now, just, you know, obviously we played against the down a bunch of times this year, and just the way we're exploiting the short roll and the drive and dive, it's like compared to the first 15 games of the season, like, I mean, Carla put on a clinic, I thought, yesterday playing with Meg, just with the drive and dive against the down. Then, you know, we see some switching. They know what to go to against the switch. We see some drops in the middle, and it's great because it's, we feel like we want to play against a cover so well that the opponent are forced to change and pick a different cover. Mm-hmm. And then we want them to feel the same thing after three possessions going against that one. So credit to the group. They've just bought into it so well and really pleased kind of seeing the results.
And I guess bouncing off that, coach, because I think it's always fun to kind of watch the different triggers and the different flow that you guys end up getting to. But, you know, how do you balance a year one where we're trying to establish foundation? So how well can we do this versus the overall, okay, we're going to have the answers to whatever issue you present to us. How do you balance that out, especially early in this season?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it starts with having really clear frameworks for the players. And I think we actually gave the players the why in terms of I remember in training camp, I explained, I was like, this is going to be the smallest playbook you've ever had in your whole career. But the detail that we're going to go into is good. And sometimes it's going to be annoying. It's going to seem like I'm pedantic, but you know, just, I remember we spent 15 minutes in practice 2 days ago in the pick and pop, just working on passes, passing without twisting their body and just coming back and being able, you know, like, and that's the type of thing where I feel like that's also player development, because they're getting so much better within the context of offense, defense. I think now that we're establishing this base foundation, I think if we do add a little bit more in year two, I do think it's going to be more effective. But then I think you're always fighting that balance, because it's this great Mike D'Antoni quote where it's everything you install in your offense, everything extra is an extra brick to carry. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's so good, because I think the more you add, I think the harder it is to be incredibly intentional and then to actually have the skills to execute those things. So, you know, I'm much more, all right, we're going to run Spain pick and roll. We're going to see four covers and we're going to be masterful in how we play against these four covers. And then maybe in year two, we have two or three different wrinkles of our Spain and two or three different entries into it, if that makes sense. But then the base foundation is established.
Oh, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think related to that, especially as you went into some of the specific drilling that you were going into with the passing in particular, just the concept of CLA, I know you've been asked about it quite a bit at this point. I guess my general question to you was, how long did it take for the players to buy in? Because I think it's clear by now they have bought in. Was it an immediate day one? Okay, this is what coach wants us to do. Let's try our best. Was it like, I need to see a week and now there's a light bulb moment? What was that process like from your point of view?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, firstly, guys, I will say I love the "this isn't the first question," which it often is on every podcast. And you know, I am the biggest advocate for CLA out there. You know, I wrote a book on it, which was great, because I
literally book
made me better. You know, it was like me, right? It forced me to become a better coach. That was actually the reason I did it. I you know, but it's about a lot more than CLA, and I think it's a huge part of our identity, no doubt. And do we think it's a big competitive advantage? 100%. But at the end of the day, it's like the stuff we just spoke about, the principles of play are the most important thing, because if you don't have really clear, coherent, modern principles of play on offense or defense, to be honest, CLA is completely irrelevant. And I unfortunately, guys, there are huge misconceptions in the media regarding what CLA is. And it's definitely not it's not like an offense or defensive system. That's completely not what it is. It's something that any coach could use to basically bring their philosophy to life. And that's how we view it here. It's just a training framework for how we practice, what we do in the weight room, and then what we're doing in performance for rehab, return to play. So I think it's so important. And I think we got buy-in early on more from the offense defense being really sound, being really modern, getting good principles. And then, to be honest, I think the CLA is just very, you know, things like us practicing in socks. We've literally done that for 10 minutes out of over like 3,000 minutes a year, right? It's like a tiny slice of it. Most of the time, it's all just recreating bits of the offense defense and just putting them in small-sided games with constraints. And I don't think it's that foreign to the players. Like when you explain it to them, it's kind of like, well, let's spend more time playing basketball just in more specific settings. And then I think we got buy-in just because the group felt like they were getting better from it. And they felt like every practice is different. They don't know what to look forward to every day because we're always coming with new tweaks, new ideas. And I think it's, you know, as human beings, it's like when we're learning it releases like endorphins in the brain, and it makes us feel good about ourselves. And that's kind of how I view it with using the CLA in practice. When you're learning, all right, we're gonna beat the drop three different ways, we're gonna punish a switch four different ways, play against the down two different ways, and then you learn all these things, I think you naturally start feeling good about yourself.
Well, I'll bring it back to player development, as you mentioned a little bit earlier. How do you kind of divvy up, because you've got a lot of players have developed and grown this year, I think, within everything you want to do offensively and defensively. how do you kind of balance who they are right now versus who they could be and what you need them to be right now?
Ooh, great question. Really, really loving this. So firstly, with the PD, I'd say we made it kind of the foundation of, and then the culture of what we do. So what I mean by that is every single practice, we actually start with 20 minutes of PD time. And that's regardless of if it's a low, moderate, or a high day. We call it the PD playground, because your job is to explore, adapt, and just be playful. Try new things. This is kind of your opportunity in playground time. It's not necessarily about competing and winning a drill. It's more about you being exploratory in your behaviors. So you're going to try finishes that you might not often try when we're just doing a normal small-sided game in practice and you're competing, you know, full on against the practice players or each other. So that really is the culture of what we do. And then we have another thing called the shooter's sandbox, which is, it's a similar idea. And that's kind of a lot of our differential learning, where you're coming in using different stances, using different arcs. You know, I think a great example is you watch Steph Curry shoot. That's a prime example of our shooter's sandbox. You're being playful in nature and no shot is the same. So we kind of, those two are very, they're things we do every single day. And then even pregame warmups is PD time. So I'm often out there with my contest stick joining in. We're playing defense and we're just great, basically using guided defense to recreate what we might see that night in the game. So I think we've tried to basically elevate PD to the forefront of what we're doing and creating this culture where every second counts. And, you know, the most important thing every day when we start the day with our staff is, I honestly don't really like coach meetings, and I just can't sit for long in the same room. We get out on the court, and we're on the court for like 45 minutes or an hour, and we're just going through details of how the practice players need to guard, the exact positioning, the covers. And I think that's really been a key part of the PD, like being obsessive with how we use them, because it's, you know, it's such a luxury to have these guys. And then that kind of translates over to the PD. And I think going back to the original question, because I do want to answer it, Steve, but I thought that was, you know, good context to answer the question. I think then it's different goals that we have in the PD. So it's, you know, it could be a 100-meter sprint where, all right, we need this for the next game. We need to be able to make this pocket going left into Meg, and then we got to read on the short roll, get our cut slide, make the right decision in this 3-on-2. Or it could be a 400-meter goal, which could be 1 or 2 months, or it could be a marathon. And that's typically something related to, like, a good example would be getting Sarah Williams being able to space and shoot threes, right? That might be a season thing, an off season. So it's having these different types of goals in PD. And then the one thing we haven't got set up right now is I want a really robust system with PD logging and players getting, we're very close to doing it. It just takes a long time to set up, where I almost want like gamified reports where they're getting, you know, info based on what they're hitting or not hitting in games. And then you get like Duolingo streaks if you're hitting a goal 5 games in a row. But, you know, it takes a long time to get those things going, but we're getting there. And I'm really pleased every day. I feel like we're making the right steps with our PD.
I love that. I have a quick spacing question that I want to ask you about some of the individual players on your team that they have. And so, like, one of the things that's popped for me, and I've talked to Steve about this as well, is like, again, the different spacing alignments that you can get into when you're setting up just your general offense and your pick and roll offense in particular. But the way that you kind of pair that with, at least as of recording, in terms of like the average distance of your pick and rolls, they're generally lower than a lot of teams in the league. And so I just kind of wanted to get from your point of view, what are the benefits to running some of those ball screens lower on the floor versus having your traditional spread pick and roll, and what kind of goes into when you go to those looks?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think a lot of it is because we run so much empty side pick and roll. And I think a really important part of that is, so we call them shapes with these pick and roll spacings. And we essentially have 6 core shapes. And I'd say 3 of them we run in the highest frequency. And then, you know, even the ATOs we run, we make sure that every ATO ends in one of these shapes. So we never want to avoid a situation that we haven't practiced and that we don't have a shared understanding of what we're trying to exploit out of that particular setting. But I think clear pick and roll, it's really advantageous to us for a few reasons. I think firstly, let's talk about Carla as our primary handler. So, you know, I really pick the shapes around her, and teams stealing unders, well, clear is a perfect shape for that because there's lots of space paired with our cut slide. When we get the timing of it, which we do pretty well, there's so much space for Carla just to race that it becomes very challenging to concede unders and just stay in neutral. So that's one reason. And then when we emphasize when we do run clear, being very deliberate with Carla to bring the ball as low as possible. So I think that's partly that will explain that metric. You know, what happened earlier in the season is we'd be running our clear, but it would be really high up the floor or basically on the slot. And instead it's, you know, and if teams down you, okay, you can only get it so low. But if I think there's a lot of opportunities when you're playing just against regular drops to really, we call it win your spot in relation to the pick and roll shape. And the ball handler, you have to win your spot to make sure that you're actually getting the ball to the right location here. And because we're running that clear so much, naturally it means trying to bring it low and playing off that. And then also on the twist, some of those rescreens we are getting inside the three-point line when we don't have the race. So I think those would probably explain it. But I think with the shapes, it's really what I've been most excited about is seeing our players understand, all right, against this type of coverage, this shape is really advantageous for us. And then understanding how the shape we're in impacts the coverage solution and what we're looking for. I mean, that's quite high level things to learn in 3 months. So I'm just really happy with how they're doing with that. And then, you know, the entries like the Iverson and all of that, really those just end always in one of our known primary shapes.
Okay, that makes a ton of sense. I guess just to stick right there, I wanted to ask you about Carla Late, who among many players having career years in Portland right now. But I wanted to ask, from your view, what do you think has been her biggest growth area from the beginning of the season to where we are right now?
Oh, great question. I would say Carla is obsessed with getting better and details. Like we've run so many individual like sessions. She's asking me for clips, which is incredible. And you know, we're on the plane and we're just going through the subtleties of pick and roll. Like I sent her a couple weeks ago, I sent her a really good video with Steve Nash just talking about setups, pick and roll setups, because it's something we've really been getting detailed with in terms of I think at the start of the year, I think Carla just relied on speed and that was it. I honestly don't think she had a really clear intent with what she was trying to achieve out of the pick and roll. And I also felt like sometimes she would predetermine her passes versus really just reading where the tags were, where help is coming from, etc. And to her credit, she has just, I mean, watching even yesterday against the Mavs, I thought she was in complete control of the game in the pick and roll, just like her grip on the affordances were like masterful. And I think the difference is now it's being more patient with the setup and knowing that we want her to come off the pick and roll with a 2-on-1 where she arrives without her primary defender. And she's learned that it doesn't always have to be just coming off fast and then they can like bully, cancel, get over. It's how you set it up. It could just be a quick hesitation or a freeze dribble to get that defender off you, a little skate. Sometimes it could be more of a reject, and we really emphasize trying to lead the league in rejects with Carla. That's one thing I've been very deliberate with her. But now it's like you do those things. Now when you come off the pick and roll, you're going to have so much time and space. And now I think she's really got the perfect mix, knowing where to look. And that's something I'm really deliberate with teaching playmakers in terms of coaching the eyes. It's a really good phrase I got from an Aussie coach, Coach Pete Lonergan, and it's scanning while you're coming off. And then I think the next level of that is incorporating some more no looks into Carla's game, but it's coming off and knowing, all right, I've got to be aggressive to threaten the drive, knowing that this will open up the pocket versus early in the season, when she's too passive and it looks like she's going to pass, then it's like a warning sign for the defender in coverage to get back or for the defense to tag. So I think those are like the next level things, just more deception with passing and no looks and how you're using your body to, I told her to to watch some bird highlights and just you know, look at some of the amazing like no looks and Hezzy's coming off the pick that Sue would use. But I think I also think that we can explore using more hostages with Carla. I think that's something that would really help, like knowing when to just come off and sometimes just completely stop, keep them on your back. And that I think that could pair pretty well with a Gortat with our bigs. So I'm excited because we got so much room to get better still, but I'm very pleased with what we're seeing already.
I love that. I was just saying, I was having a conversation with someone yesterday about Carla late bounce passes. So it's very funny that we've kind of gone full circle here. She's gotten so good at like some of those late dump offs to the bigs in particular, yes, that you spoke to. So I love the Carla shout there. Quickly to the defense, because Portland has been pretty easily the most aggressive defense in basketball by a lot of different metrics. You already talked a little bit about some of the influences to that. I wanted to ask you specifically about Emily Inksler and what it's like having a four that can execute that many things and can guard that many players.
Oh, wow. Well, I think Emma's been a perfect fit for these principles of play in terms of being disruptive. I think, and we've given her freedom just to, in certain games, we just call it spy, where she can basically just be the all-time help defender and just basically be a, make plays, be a defensive quarterback and disrupt. And I think she's really picked that up so well. And, you know, we've seen it just in terms of the production and rim protection, steals, like it's all there. And I do think our defense is getting better. I think it's really interesting. I mean, we had the fourth best net rating defensively in July. I was shocked. Brittany Donaldson, our lead assistant, texted me that this morning. I with my morning coffee, I was shocked. And our pick and roll defense is third best in the league. So those are really good signs. Where we're really getting hurt is two areas. It's our defensive rebounding and our transition. And a lot of that transition was linked to missed rim attempts and live ball turnovers. So it's more of those live balls where it's so hard to get your defense set. So I think that's the next level to where we need to go as a team. I think I'm really happy with the schemes and how it fits players like M, like great. And I think now we've got to do whatever we can in the off season to really look at rebounding and fixing some of those things.
I got you. Last player one that I had, and I'll toss it to Steve if he has any. With Bridget Carlton being like the top pick for the Portland Fire, obviously a lot more role expansion for her in Portland compared to what the last year in Minnesota was. Like, what did you specifically identify in her to kind of showcase, that kind of led you to believe, okay, she does just have more in the tank that we can kind of pull out of her?
Yeah, absolutely. So I can't remember the initial stat, but it was something really interesting where it was obviously a ton of second spectrum in the months leading up to the expansion. But Bridget was like the 92nd percentile, I think, in efficiency, points per shot, and then bottom 10th percentile in usage and volume. So, and there are a bunch of other metrics that really popped when we were looking at that. And I think just with the way we're playing, to have a player who's elite at both ends in terms of setting, kind of leading by example with the defense and just, you know, being such a competitor on that end of the floor to navigate off-ball screens, to do a great job disrupting in the pick and roll when as our plug defender, to being in the right position off the ball and then just guarding one-on-one without conceding blow-bys. Like, Bridget is just incredible in all those areas. And then you look at the offense now and she's got the complete green light. And I think she's really learned how to take shots which are efficient for us, that maybe she hasn't taken before, but they're great shots for us. And understanding that, you know, even a contested three is, if they can't alter your shot, it's open. We want you to shoot it. And that's obviously paired a lot with all the CLA kind of differential learning shooting practice that we have her do, where, you know, she's practicing these shots on a daily basis. But yeah, I'm really happy. I think the biggest thing there too with Bridget that you don't always catch from just the metrics is how she's leading the group. Like, it's always, it's always her kind of initiating teammates to be in the right spots, reminding about ATO plays and kind of initiating these dead ball huddles and just using our specific language to try and influence the next possession. And she's doing an incredible job in that regard.
All right, Coach. Appreciate you being here. I have one final question. This is not your first time in Portland. I am from Portland. What is your go-to ice cream selection at Salt and Straw?
Oh, that's a great question. So I am in Alberta. I live in Alberta, and there's a Salt and Straw right here. It's like a 15-minute walk from my place. So I often frequent that branch. So I love it. What is it? It's like the chocolate. It's the most un-Salt and Straw like flavor there is. Yep. It's like triple chocolate brownie, which I absolutely love. I think I'm more of a traditionalist from all the years in Italy. They also, I do like the balsamic strawberry sometimes on occasion too.
Nice. There we go. That's what I'm talking about, Coach.
Well done. We start with saxophones. We end with ice cream. A whole bunch of basketball in the middle. This is what we do. Coach, thank you again for taking the time out. Wish you the best with the rest of the season. I hope you are able to get some rest during this All-Star break as well.
Oh, thank you so much, guys. This was a pleasure. I really appreciated the questions. So thank you again for having me come on.
All right, we're going to take a break right here. But when we return, Chicago Sky rookie forward Gabriella Hawkes joins the show. We ask her about her rookie season. We also ask her a little bit about her fashion sense. We hope you enjoy. Please stay tuned. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. We have a very special guest joining us. We have Chicago Sky rookie Gabriella Hawkes on the program today. Gabriella, hi, how are you? Thank you for joining the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
No problem, no problem. I want to get right into it as you are, again, in the midst of a quality rookie season so far. But it always feels like such a whirlwind for rookies to go from the college season, especially someone that played as deep into the tourney as you and ultimately won a championship. What has the adjustment period been like for you?
Yeah, it's been such a whirlwind. I mean, it goes by so fast. I think I did know it was going to go by fast, but I don't think until you experience, you really know what to expect. But overall, I'm just so thankful and grateful. I'm living out my dream.
Yeah. What does rest look like for you these days?
Yeah, I think rest is really important, making sure I'm taking my off days and just getting enough sleep and eating.
Got you. The one basketball question I want to start with is you are going from a UCLA system that lit college basketball on fire last year and really for multiple seasons, but particularly last year. You now shift to the Chicago system offensively, which is still centered around big. So I kind of want to know from your view, how similar are kind of the core principles of the UCLA offense compared to the Chicago offense?
Yeah, I would say it's definitely different in the sense that you're going to have different coaches. It's college compared to pro. And I've been loving both. I think it's important to play different style of basketball. And also, you know, playing with Lauren Betts, a great big, and then now playing with Camila Cardoso as well, an amazing big as well. So I think it's always great to have a rim protector and a post player inside to dominate down there. But then also just making sure getting the guards in action, making sure we're getting them downhill and good shots.
Well, I'll add this question. How much did playing for that deep, talented UCLA team help you prepare for playing in the pros, if at all?
Yeah, I think it really helped. I mean, you can really call it a WNBA team with, you know, six draftees and now in the WNBA. So I think it really prepared me and made me compete even harder because we got to compete with each other in practice and just really work together to be the best we can be and to all follow our dreams playing in the WNBA.
I think bouncing off of that, I think one of the calling cards for you entering the draft was your ability to do pretty much whatever was asked of you. You could be on ball, could be off ball, could play off of star talent, et cetera. For someone that can fill as many gaps as you do, is it sometimes difficult to kind of find your own rhythm because there isn't like a specific thing that you're asked to do every night?
I don't think so. I think going into any game, just ready to compete and ready to grab some rebounds, defend, score. And I think that's what makes basketball fun is just, and me playing and just going and doing whatever the team needs. And I think that's a really big skill because it's not just about one thing and you want to be versatile out there on the court.
I guess to that end, to back up a little bit, who were some of your basketball influences growing up?
Yeah, I would definitely say my parents influenced me in my basketball journey, as well as my older brother. I think that both my parents played in college, so they were my coaches, and my mom coached me from a young age, and my dad obviously helped as well. And, you know, growing up watching my older brother play basketball just really inspired me.
Oh, makes sense. Makes sense. I want to shift to the defensive end very quickly, as you have been a very good defender, one, but two, you've been tasked with defending multiple players, multiple player types, multiple positions, both in college and in the W. What does preparation look like for you?
I think preparation looks like for me, especially defensively, is making sure I'm really understanding the person I'm guarding, knowing their tendencies. And our coaches set us up for success, give us an amazing scout on how we're going to defend, but then also making sure I can rely on my teammates for having them in help and being in the gaps. And it's really hard to guard people one-on-one, and there are amazing, talented players out there. And so just having that trust in your teammates as well, but obviously getting excited for that one-on-one assignment and trying to be the best defender you can be.
Who's been your toughest cover so far, if you can share?
Oh, I think probably Jackie Young has been really hard to guard, honestly. She's an amazing player, but it's really fun, you know, every night competing against amazing players. I mean, every defensive assignment excites me because it's just going to get me better.
What would you say is the most underrated part of being a good defender?
I think an underrated part about being a good defender is not fouling.
That's good. Yes. I like that. It's hard to play defense if you're not on the court, if you can't be physical. That makes a lot of sense.
Because you got to be able to, you know, defend without fouling. I think it's really hard, you know, trying to be physical, but then making sure you're not fouling is important.
Is the physicality allowed different on the W side versus the college side for you?
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, different in its own way. I think, especially in the Final Four National Championship games, those were really physical in the NCAA tournament. You know, in college, it starts not as physical and then gets more physical throughout the season, but that's a known thing. And then in the WNBA, yeah, it's definitely physical. I think every game is going to be different. So you got to just kind of read it and see what the refs are calling.
Got you. Have you had your welcome to the league moment yet?
You know, people have asked me that. I don't even know, really. I don't know if I've had a specific moment yet, but I think just, you know, it's just really fun every game. I think, you know, starting off the season, our first game was at Portland. It was like sold out with 20,000 people. And I'm just like, wow, this is crazy. But again, super grateful. This is my dream. This is what I want to be doing. But it's just crazy to think about. I was just in college a few weeks ago and now I'm playing in the WNBA.
I would imagine that is quite the whirlwind for you. Actually, more of an off-court question. When you do have downtime, how are you spending? Are you watching anything or any particular hobbies that you tap into to kind of decompress from basketball?
Yeah, I think mainly for me, I love shopping and I love doing crafts, obviously watching some shows, and just really relaxing, enjoying the nice Chicago scenery out there.
We like that. We like that. I guess one quick Sky question to close things out. Who's the best tunnel fit player on the roster?
Oh, that's a good one. I think that we have a lot of amazing, stylish people on our team. I definitely pop out, not every single game, but all here and there, I'll wear a nice fit, which I like. But yeah, I think that, you know, Ricky obviously got hurt, but her tunnel fits are always cool. Tasha Clouds are cool. I mean, I can name so many because everyone has their moments for sure.
Oh, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. Well, thank you, Gabriella, for joining us. We appreciate you taking the time out.
Thank you so much.
Wish you the best for the rest of your season.
Thank you.
Thank you to all the dunkers that sent in questions to the Dunker Spot email. Thank you, Alex Rama, for joining us. Thank you, Gabriella Hawkes, for joining us. Thank you, Steve, for rocking with me. And thank you all for listening to and or watching this episode of the Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcast, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel for all of our NBA content. Subscribe to the Yahoo Sports main YouTube channel for all of our WNBA content. You can follow me on socials at Nikias NBA. You can follow Steve on socials at Steve Jones 20. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.